With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's start tonight off with some cool tunes. Well, hello there, and in the news this week, the carbon footprint of Brazilian beef plus the health effects of pollution and electrification in this week's Earth and Environment reports. Heart attacks. Does pollution constitute a common trigger? Well, compared to using cocaine, eating a heavy meal, or undertaking a physically exerting task, air pollution is not a particularly potent trigger for heart attacks, a Belgian-Swiss research team finds. Now, owing to pollution's ubiquity, however, readily inhaled fine particles under 10 micrometers in diameter appear to underlie as many non-fatal heart attacks as far as more potent triggers. The researchers report their results, which are based on 36 previously published studies in the February 26th Lancet. And let's take a look at the health impacts of global electrification. Rapidly developing countries like India and China have undertaken wholesale urban electrification, but pollution associated with the coal plants on which these nations rely can pose health trade-offs, explains an international team of scientists. Working with data for 41 countries on projected development trajectories, health demographics, and coal emissions, the researchers project that rising electricity consumption will improve health only where pre-electrification infant mortality is below 1 in 10 live births. In an upcoming issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, the researchers describe why increased electricity will, quote, not lead to greater health benefits, unquote. And ice down below, Antarctica's massive ice sheet stays pretty thick, partly because water freezes at its base, a new study shows. Researchers had known that these ice sheets thicken as snow falls on top and compacts. Now scientists led by Robin Bell of the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in Palisades, New York, have used radar to probe the base of East Antarctica's ice sheet. They find that water freezing from the bedrock below can account in places for up to half the ice thickness. The finding, reported online March 3rd in Science, could help inform the quest to drill into the world's oldest ice. And with all of the controversy regarding greenhouse gases and beef consumption, why don't we take a look at the rainforest's carbon hoofprints. As farmers clear tropical rainforests in Brazil to make room for cattle ranching, carbon that had been stored in the felled trees will be released into the atmosphere, a trend that can foster global warming. The likely carbon footprint attributable to this land use change during the first two decades following deforestation can exceed 700 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of beef carcass, a team of researchers in Sweden and England calculated. Now, that value is, quote, orders of magnitude larger than the figure for beef production on established pasture on non-deforested land, unquote. They explained this in the March 1st issue of Environmental Science and Technology. And in this report, some plants could actually be Typhoid Marys. A British research team has identified strains of Salmonella capable of making leafy greens sick. The scientists infected the weed Arabidopsis thaliana, which is the lab rat of plants, with Salmonella enterica, and these germs are ones that ordinarily cause gut-wrenching disease in people. Some strains cause the plants to wilt and turn sickly yellow. The scientists reported this online February 23rd in Environmental Microbiology. Other strains elicited no visible disease despite surviving up to 8 days inside the leaves. This suggests that some germs that evolved to grow in the mammalian gut may hitchhike to their next host embedded deep inside salad leaves where they can't be rinsed off. Which means that if this particular germ was inside the leaf, you wouldn't be able to rinse it off. Therefore, there has to be some sort of a detection method to be able to make these leafy greens okay for human consumption. And in this report, a new system can warn of tsunamis within minutes. Seismologists have developed a new system that could be used to warn future populations of an impending tsunami only minutes after the initial earthquake. The system, known as RT-ERG, could help reduce the death toll by giving local residents valuable time to move to safer ground. The study by researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology appears in the March 5th edition of Geophysical Research Letters if you want to read more, but here's a little bit about this. Quote, we developed a system in real time, successfully identified the magnitude 7.8 2010 Sumatran earthquake as a rare and destructive tsunami earthquake. Using this system, we could in the future warn local populations, thus minimizing the death toll from tsunamis, unquote, said Andrew Newman, assistant professor in the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. Now, typically, a large subduction zone earthquake ruptures at a rate near 3 kilometers per second and anywhere from 20 kilometers to 50 kilometers below the Earth's surface. Because of the depth, vertical deformation of the crust is horizontally smoothed. It causes the size of uplift to remain rather small. When these earthquakes occur in the ocean, the resulting waves may only measure about 20 centimeters high for a magnitude of 7.8 event. Tsunami earthquakes, however, are a rare class of earthquakes that rupture more slowly at 1 to 1.5 kilometers per second and propagate up to the sea floor near the trench. This makes the vertical uplift much larger, resulting in nearby wave heights up to 10 to 20 meters in nearby coastal environments, such as the case of the Sumatran earthquake, which reported wave heights of up to 17 meters, causing a death toll of approximately 430 people. Now, because tsunami earthquakes rupture in a shallow environment, we can't simply use a measurement of magnitude to determine which ones will create large waves, said Newman. When they occur, people often don't feel that they're significant, even if they feel them in the first place, because they seem like they're an order of magnitude smaller than they actually are. Tsunami earthquakes typically rupture more slowly, last longer, and are less efficient at radiating energy, so when the RT-ERG uses its algorithmic tools to find a quake matching these attributes, it sends an alert to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, as well as the United States Geological Survey's National Earthquake Information Center. Here's how it works. Okay, usually within 4 minutes, RT-ERG gets a notification from one of the tsunami warning centers that an earthquake has occurred. This notice gives the system the quake's location, depth, and approximate magnitude. If the earthquake is determined to be of magnitude 6.5 or higher, it takes about a minute to request and receive data from around 150 seismic stations around the world. Once it collects the data, it uses its algorithm to run through every second of the rupture and determine the incremental growth of energy and ascertain whether the quake was a tsunami earthquake. Newman and his team have used seismology readings from previous tsunami earthquakes, such as the one in Nicaragua in 1992 and the one that hit Java in 2006, but the Sumatran event was the first tsunami quake that occurred when RT-ERG was online in real time. With that quake, the system identified the event as a potential tsunami earthquake after 8.5 minutes and sent a notification out shortly thereafter. When applied to production warning system, the tool will be most valuable since analysts are available 24/7 to evaluate the algorithm results. For most tsunami earthquakes, inundation of coastal environment doesn't occur until about 30 or 40 minutes after the quake. So we'll have about 20 to 30 minutes to get our information to an automatic warning system or also to the authorities, Newman said. Now, this gives us a tangible amount of time to get people out of the way. Currently, Newman and his team are working to test and implement a technique for RT-ERG that could shave another minute or more from the warning time. In addition, they're planning to rewrite the algorithm so that it can be used at all U.S. and international warning centers. And all this information was provided by the Georgia Institute of Technology. And speaking of warning systems, nature has them too. Plants are hoarding water as the CO2 rises. According to this study, there's been a huge reduction in the release of water to the atmosphere. Florida's vegetation has changed its structure over the last century in response to rising atmospheric carbon dioxide, and ecologists see the change as a plant-based call to arms heralding dry times to come. Plants breathe in air and breathe out moisture through tiny pores called stomata. Comparing a variety of contemporary plants growing in Florida with museum samples and peat bogs dating back 150 years ago, an international team of ecologists found that as the amount of carbon dioxide in the air increased, the number of stomata on plants' leaves have decreased. Team of ecologists from Utrecht University in the Netherlands, working with David Dilcher of Indiana University in Bloomington, published two papers on their work in the recent proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, our first paper shows the connection between temperature, transpiration, and stomata density, Dilcher said in an Indiana University press release. Quote, the second paper really is about applying what we know to the future. Water evaporates from a plant through its stomata, driving the plant's need to uptake more water from its surrounding soil. Fewer stomata means less water is being released into the air in a process called transpiration. The increase in carbon dioxide by about 100 parts per million has a profound effect on the number of stomata and, to a lesser extent, the size of the stomata, Dilcher said. The team predicts that further increases in carbon dioxide will halve the amount of water lost to the atmosphere. That reduction in water could have serious effects on rainfall and other weather events. The researchers found that on the density of stomata packed on plants' leaves has decreased by 34% over the last 150 years. The team concludes that while plants can alter the number of stomata on their leaves from season to season, the effects of such long-term sustained changes in stomata numbers are driving changes in the water cycle. Our analysis of that structural change shows there's a huge reduction in the release of water to the atmosphere, Dilger said. Now, the carbon cycle is important, but so is the water cycle, according to Dilger. America's most famous wetland, the Everglades, already suffer from the loss of groundwater used for agriculture, industry, and human habitation in the north of the state. And if transpiration decreases, there may be more moisture in the ground at first, but if there's less rainfall, that may mean that there's less moisture in the ground eventually. This is part of the hydrogeologic cycle. Now, land plants are a very crucial, important part of it, Dilger said, and if you want to read more, you can look for those papers. We're going to keep you updated on this particular study, and this is very important because we are able to actually match the plants now with the plants then, and we can see the changes, regardless of whether or not this goes into the debate over, what's causing the CO2 increase. That's a whole other story. Of course, we talk about that all the time. But like I said, if you want to know more about that, go to those two papers, and we're going to keep an eye on Dr. Dilger and his work in this area. And now it's about time for another little music break. Here you go.
Hey kid, do I have your attention? I know the way you've been living. Life's so reckless, tragedy endless. Welcome to the family. Hey, there's something missing. Only time will alter your vision. Never in question, lethal injection. Welcome to the family.
Not long ago you find the answers were so crystal clear.
Fine.
Now, when we talk about the environment, which we just have been, and many other areas of research in science in the United States specifically, I know there are people listening that aren't in the United States, but we are experiencing a massive across-the-board funding cut with regard to education and, you know, a lot of the grants that we depend on in the universities to fund this research that end up becoming the studies that are in the academic journals. This subject bears a lot more introspection and dialogue and a little bit of explanation, far more than I have time to go into on this show today. In 2 weeks, I'm going to do an in-depth coverage of what is peer review, how does academic funding happen, and what's the implication of these funding cuts. Now, this is not just in science, it's a cultural phenomenon that's occurring, coming directly from Congress. And there's a fantastic article that was written by Margarita Mercure Hibbs, published Thursday, March 3rd, 2011, in the Mountain View Telegraph. You can find that online, www.mvtelegraph.com. And she was honored as the front page article called "Funding Goes to the Wrong Places." I want to do a lot more about this particular subject, like I said, in 2 weeks on that show, and I'm going to spotlight this particular article and others and have a little bit more information about how the process actually works and what funding cuts mean to these programs and to you in your everyday life. So look for that. And I would also like to talk about next week, we're going to have Marcus Leader and his show, The Shaman's Brew, and my show, this one you're listening to, Savage Science Radio, combined together in a two-hour interview with Rosemary Ellen Guiley and Philip J. Imbrogno from their new collaboration of a book called The Vengeful Djinn. Marcus has put together a very good and sort of spooky trailer for this that you can find on YouTube also, and also on his page. He has it listed on Facebook, but here it is. And a lot of people look at the show like it's all pure science. Well, anthropology is also a science. Some people call it a soft science. Remember, we talked about that, and there's a lot of anthropologists just about, you know, drop their jaw when they redefined it within this academic science culture recently, and they're probably still a little upset about it, I can imagine. And this particular report, he will be going at it from, you know, his research in the area of the meta and the metaphysics and the esoteric side of it. And of course, I come in from the science side of it to take a look at, you know, the anthropological aspects. And also, there's quite a lot mentioned in this particular book that's just been released on the science behind these hypotheses that have been proposed regarding this lore of ancient times called the djinn. Take a listen.
If you fear one thing in your life, fear the djinn. An ancient Arabian legend says that God made humans from mud and clay, angels from light, and the djinn from smokeless fire. In the Western world, many people readily accept the idea of angels and demons, but most have no knowledge of the djinn, called God's other people. According to legend, the djinn were the first inhabitants of this world, where they lived for thousands of years before humanity arrived. In order to make room for humans, angels took the djinn out of this world and placed them in a dimension that parallels our own. There they stay hidden from our view. They have the ability to see and interact with us, but we have difficulty seeing them. They are cloaked in mystery, and it suits their covert purpose. The goal of most djinn is to retake this world, which they feel rightfully belongs to them. In order to succeed, they must first make humanity give up stewardship of this reality. They are accomplishing this by stealth and disguise. They have great powers and plenty of time, for they live for centuries. Shapeshifting djinn may be responsible for many forms of paranormal phenomenon and experience, such as UFOs, shadow people, ghosts, poltergeists, and demonic possession. In such ways, they gain access to us that enables them to steal our life force and information about us, and to manipulate and use us without revealing their true form and purpose. These negative experiences are on the rise. In their new book, The Vengeful Djinn, authors Philip J. Imbrogno and Rosemary Ellen Guiley, two of the leading experts on the paranormal, present the findings of their in-depth investigation of the djinn. Who they are, what they're doing, and how can they be countered. Rosemary and Phil have established djinnuniverse.com as an educational website about these mysterious and powerful beings. To learn more about the djinn and their actions in our world, be sure to order your copy of their groundbreaking and revealing book, The Vengeful Djinn, on the link provided on the homepage. All copies are autographed by both Rosemary Ellen Guiley and Phil Imbrogno. So be sure to visit djinnuniverse.com. That's djinnuniverse.com. The djinn may be one of the greatest dangers to ever present itself to the human race. Now their mask is off.
Well, there it is. And if you will remember, Marcus Leder and I did team up our shows once before for an interview with Rosemary Ellen Guiley back in October of last year for a Halloween special on the vampires. And she had written the Encyclopedia of Vampires, and she's a fantastic author and one of my favorite people. So stay tuned for that. And if you want to see the trailer yourself, you can look up The Vengeful Djinn, D-J-I-N-N, if you're not familiar with that term. And it's under Rosemary Guiley's YouTube page. It's fantastic. It's kind of spooky. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. And meanwhile, back over on the ranch of genes and cell news, let's take a look at a virus that's off the hook for cancer and fatigue. A virus that has been implicated in causing prostate cancer and chronic fatigue syndrome may be a laboratory contamination problem and not a human pathogen after all. The XMRV virus supposedly causes disease by integrating itself into human DNA. But a new study shows that previous experiments that found the virus inserted into human genes were faulty due to contamination from a laboratory technique that replicates DNA. The observation was reported February 25th in the online journal Retrovirology by researchers at Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and University College London, and it adds to the evidence calling XMRV's role in human disease into question. Iron RNA, microRNA involved in hepatitis C infections, also helps regulate iron levels in the liver, a new study shows. This microRNA, called MIR-122, was already known to regulate cholesterol production. Now, researchers in Germany and Denmark show that the microRNA is needed to keep up iron levels in the liver and blood. Antiviral therapies and cholesterol-lowering treatments have proposed to reduce the amount of MIR-122 made in the liver. The new findings published online March 1st in the Journal of Clinical Investigation could mean that dropping the microRNA's level too low could lead to iron deficiency. And getting to the root of chemo failure, a few cellular proteins may determine when chemotherapy fails. A host of chemo drugs often can't kill cells missing one protein called FBW7. International teams report in two papers appearing in the March 3rd issue of Nature has this protein, the teams say, that seems to keep certain cellular chemicals in check. These baddies sustain cell life even as outside signals like chemo drugs go for the kill. The chemotherapy stymied by this loss include treatments like Taxol and vincristine, which target a range of cancers from breast and ovarian tumors to leukemia. Screens for FBW7 in tumors before chemotherapy could help oncologists better tailor their treatments, researchers say. So we're going to keep an eye on that. I have that on my alert. That's a big deal. And this week's news in the body and the brain, ibuprofen may help fend off Parkinson's, plus bone boosters and smokers' brains. Let's get going on this. Now, caregiver error. People who care for elderly people still living at home are prone to make mistakes with medication, suggests a study in an upcoming issue of the Journal of General Internal Medicine. When tested, more than half of 98 caregivers who had volunteered for the study showed difficulty understanding prescription labels, leading to errors in assigning proper amounts of medications to daily pill boxes, researchers from Northwestern University School of Medicine in Chicago have reported. Even though more than 85% of the workers performed health-related tasks for seniors as part of their jobs, one-third failed a basic health literacy test administered by the scientists. That is shocking. Look for that in an upcoming journal issue of the Journal of Internal Medicine. Oh my goodness. Ibuprofen. Ibuprofen versus Parkinson's. People who take the anti-inflammatory drug ibuprofen at least twice a week may be less prone to Parkinson's disease. Researchers have reported this online March 2nd issue of Neurology. In a six-year study of more than 136,000 health professionals, ibuprofen users were 38% less likely than people not taking it to develop Parkinson's. The extent of this reduction may be as much as 58% or as little as 7%, statistical analysis shows. When six other studies that also tracked people prospectively were included in the analysis, the apparent benefit from ibuprofen use remained, with a risk reduction of 15 to 37%. Acetaminophen and anti-inflammatory drugs such as aspirin and naproxen showed no effect. And here's a story, sweet sex differences. Woo! High levels of fructose in a mother's diet during pregnancy may affect the development of male and female fetuses differently. This was from a study in rats. Mother rats that drank about 22% of their daily calories in the form of high fructose sweetener had daughters with small placentas. Researchers from the University of Auckland in New Zealand reported this in a paper to appear in the April issue of Endocrinology. Male fetuses had placentas comparable in size to those of sons from water-drinking moms. So, female offspring of the fructose-drinking moms also had different levels of metabolic hormone called leptin than their brothers or the offspring of water-consuming moms did. And here's a story about nitrate boosts bone density. Very interesting. Glycerol trinitrate, or nitroglycerin, may strengthen bones when absorbed through the skin. Scientists reported this in the February 23rd issue of Journal of the American Medical Association. An international research team randomly assigned 243 postmenopausal women to receive ointment containing either nitroglycerin or a placebo. Each woman squeezed out 1 inch of ointment nightly onto a patch and taped it onto her arm. Women getting nitroglycerin showed a 5 to 8% increase in density of spine, pelvis, and thigh bones after 2 years, while those getting the placebo ointment had little change. But 35% of women taking nitroglycerin for the first 2 years reported headaches compared with 5% of the others. And sprouts. Sprouts take on cholesterol. Woohoo! Diners concerned about their heart might want to chuck some broccoli sprouts onto their salads. Renowned for fighting some cancers, these sprouts have lately shown promise as a dietary aid for lowering cholesterol. Probing the mechanism using rodents, researchers in Mexico and the United States identified a couple of chemicals in the sprouts that trigger beneficial changes in the activity of cholesterol-regulating genes within the liver. whole sprouts outperformed consumption of those just isolated constituents. They reported this in the February 23rd Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. This suggests that other chemicals in the whole food provide bonus benefits. Woohoo, eat your sprouts. And smokers' brains light up, so they don't. A brain scan predicts which smokers will kick the habit 4 months later. Researchers from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor designed individualized smoking cessation plans for 91 smokers. At the start of the program, volunteers heard tailored quitting messages while undergoing a functional MRI brain scan. People whose brains had higher activity in regions involved in self-related processing, including the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, and that was in the news quite a bit in the last few shows, were more successful at quitting after 4 months of their programs. The researchers reported this online, and if you want to read more, in the February 27th issue in Nature Neuroscience. And speaking of placebos, which they always use in these experiments, here's something that's very interesting. This was in the guardian.co.uk. Half of all German doctors prescribe placebos, a new study shows. Placebo cures shown to help with depression and stomach complaints in Bavaria. 88% of the doctors have prescribed them. Oh, boy. Okay. The power of the mind, really. Half of German doctors prescribe placebos, according to a new study for the German Medical Association. The report says placebos, from vitamin pills to homeopathic remedies or even sham surgery, can prove highly effective in various treatments. Okay. In Bavaria, it found 88% of GPs have general practitioners, I meant. Get used to abbreviating things, you know, in science. So, yeah, general practitioners, doctors, have sent patients home with prescriptions for placebo drugs. The German Medical Association, BAK, which commissioned the report, Placebos in Medicine, admitted that it doesn't fully understand how the placebos work, but welcomed the report's findings. Placebos have a stronger impact and are more complex than we realized. They are hugely important in medicine today, says Christoph Fuchs, the managing director of the BAK. The report recommends that students and doctors should be taught about placebos and their usage. Placebos can maximize the effect of medication, says Robert Jute, the author of the study and a BAK board member. They can reduce undesirable side effects and are more efficient usage of our healthcare budget. That's very interesting implication there. Recent research, he said, showed that placebos had helped 59% of patients who had been suffering from an upset stomach. Used to treat depression, placebos have the same effect as antidepressants in about a third of the cases. A third. That's humongous. The efficacy of a placebo depends on many factors, according to the report, including the size and color of a pill. This gets even more interesting as the report goes on. Now, the more expensive the placebo, the higher the success rate, and the study found with intravenous injections are shown to be more effective than oral medication. It's also a question of trust. Placebos produce better results if a patient feels their doctor understands their concerns and believes they are being taken seriously, the study says. Ethically, however, placebos are still kind of a gray area, as you can well imagine. Few doctors knew whether they could legally administer placebos, actually. Now, the study advises doctors to only prescribe placebos if the patient has a minor illness and if it seems that a placebo treatment will be successful. Patients should not be denied the use of standard medication if there's a possibility of their condition getting worse, says the report. To create a clear framework of the use of placebos, the BAK is now calling for internationally recognized guidelines, and we look forward to that, and I will be, of course, definitely following this story and bringing you any developing, reports. And here's something that will just blow your mind. You might be familiar with TED Talks, TED Talks. Their website has a lot of videos from experts in different research fields, and they have a little over 20 minutes to, you know, give their presentation on the TED stage. And one that recently happened, it was just mind-blowing. A surgeon specializing in regenerative medicine on Thursday printed a real kidney using a machine that eliminates the need for donors when it comes to organ transplants. It's like baking a cake, said Anthony Atala of the Wake Forest Institute of Regenerative Medicine said as he cooked up a fresh kidney on the stage at the TED conference in the California city of Long Beach. Scanners used to take a 3D image of a kidney that needs replacing, then a tissue sample of about half the size of a postage stamp is used to see the computerized process, Atala explained. Now the organ, quote-unquote, printer then works layer by layer to build a replacement kidney replicating the patient's tissue. College student Luke Masella was among the first people to receive a printed kidney during experimental research a decade ago when he was just 10 years old. He said he was born with spinal bifida and his kidneys were not working. Now I'm in college and basically trying to live life like a normal kid, said Masella, who was reunited with Atala at TED. Boy, is that cool. This surgery saved my life and made me who I am today, he said. Now, about 90% of people waiting for transplants are in need of kidneys specifically, and the need far outweighs the supply of donated organs, according to Atala. There's a major health crisis today in terms of the shortage of organs, Atala said. Medicine has done a much better job of making us live longer, and as we age, our organs don't last. So check that out. Wow, that's pretty exciting and pretty cool, and congratulations to Atala and his research. And in this report, this is another incredible piece of information. Scientists invented a $200 cancer-detecting gizmo that's 96% accurate. This is from Device, DVICE.com. This fantastic news is from a team of scientists at Harvard University and MIT, and they've created a $200 scanner gizmo that detects cancer in 1 hour. How life-changing is that? The handheld scanner uses antibodies and magnetic particles to seek out and flag cancer in cells, which are extracted with a needle, rather than large amounts of surgically removed tissue. Diagnostic results can then be processed on a smartphone, like the iPhone, through an app, and within 1 hour, you'll know if that tumorous tissue is cancer or not. Does this sound like Star Trek yet? Yep. Normally, a biopsy is used to scan for cancer, but those tests can only be 84% accurate, whereas with this handheld scanner, it can produce results that are much higher, 96%. With the boost in accuracy, potential cancer patients will be able to sleep a bit easier knowing that they have been properly diagnosed. This gadget isn't some ho-hum device that will never make it to your home. It costs only $200 to make and has the potential to utilize huge technology advancements in poorer countries. Think about this, where doctors and working medical equipment is scarce. It wouldn't be shocking if everyone had one of these little gizmos stowed away in their bathroom cabinets in the near future. So yeah, Star Trek once again, art imitating life. It's kind of the other way around. It's life imitating art. Sci-fi is sci-fact. Once again, fantastic. You can look that up on Gizmodo, I'm sorry, and Bloomberg, and Fizz.org had it, and also on device.com.
No!
Yeah, I know we had that song on last week, but you know what? I like it a lot, and it makes me happy, so I played it again this week. Oh, boy. And speaking of happiness, we have one of my favorite things is to find these cool stories on what makes us happy. Happiness improves health and lengthens life, review finds. Well, yeah, of course it does. Well, to those of us that are looking at that half-full cup, a review of more than 160 studies of human and animal subjects has found, quote, clear and compelling evidence that, all else being equal, happy people tend to live longer and experience better health than their unhappy peers. Well, this study in the journal Applied Psychology, Health and Well-Being is the most comprehensive review, yay, so far of the evidence linking happiness to health outcomes. The lead author, University of Illinois Professor Emeritus of Psychology Ed Diner, who also is a senior scientist for the Gallup Organization of Princeton, New Jersey, analyzed long-term studies of human subjects, experimental human and animal trials, and studies that evaluate the health status of people stressed by natural events. We reviewed 8 different types of studies, Diner said, and the general conclusion from each type of study is that your subjective well-being, that is, feeling positive about your life, not stressed out, not depressed, contributes to both longevity and better health among healthy populations. A study that followed nearly 5,000 university students for more than 40 years, for example, found that those who were most pessimistic as students tended to die younger than their peers. An even longer-term study followed 180 Catholic nuns from early adulthood to old age and found that those people who wrote positive autobiographies in their early 20s tended to outlive those who wrote more negative accounts of their young lives. There were a few exceptions, but most of the long-term studies the researchers reviewed, they found that anxiety, depression, and a lack of enjoyment of daily activities and pessimism are all associated with higher rates of disease and a shorter lifespan. Animal studies also demonstrate a strong link between stress and poor health. Experiments in which animals receive the same care but differ their stress levels as a result of an abundance of nest mates in their cages, for example, have found that stressed animals are more susceptible to heart disease, have weaker immune systems, and tend to die younger than those living in less crowded conditions. Laboratory experiments on humans have found that positive moods reduce stress-related hormones and increase immune function and promote the speedy recovery of the heart after exertions. Now, in other studies, marital conflicts and high hostility in married couples were associated with slow wound healing and a poor immune response, and we did report that on this show, as a matter of fact. I was almost shocked and certainly surprised to see the consistency of the data, Diner said. Of all these different kinds of studies point to the same conclusion that health and longevity in turn are influenced by our mood states. While happiness might not by itself prevent or cure disease, the evidence that positive emotions and enjoyment of life contribute to better health and a longer lifespan and is stronger than the data linking obesity to reduced longevity, Diner said. Happiness is no magic bullet, he said, but the evidence is clear and compelling that it changes your odds of getting disease or dying young. Although there are a handful of studies that find opposite effects, Diner said, the overwhelming majority of studies support the conclusion that happiness is associated with health and longevity. Current health recommendations focus on 4 things. Avoid obesity, eat right, don't smoke, and exercise. And maybe time to add, be happy and avoid chronic anger and depression to that list. So, we're going to leave you with a little happy tune. And as always, I would like to thank Nick Palucco for the fantastic show graphics and Dennis Baum and Hawk Productions, who did that great intro that I use every single week. And I would like to give a big shout out to Waleed Haladad, who helps me find these fantastic articles every week to enlighten and inspire you. And a special thank you to Todd Sheets for producing this show. Now, keep your powder and your pants dry and happy trails until next we meet again.
listen to the heart. The black spade.